Welcome to Unpacking Zionism. I'm Amaya Gelman, Director of the Institute for the Critical Study of Zionism. We are back from a summer hiatus during which the Israeli genocide in Palestine has continued to escalate its death-making and its normalization of horrors, and it is hard to breathe. Last month, Mohammed Al-Kurd wrote about the banality of watching genocide, and I want to start there, and you should go read it yourself as well. He writes, "You know, the killing is so relentless that you almost get used to it. A classroom of children killed every single day. You write about it, you read about it. Someone's mother digs herself up from the rubble. Someone's father is split in half. There was a video of a wounded man using his arms to crawl across the road. Another man is so hungry he weeps. You read the stories. Each one is more brutal than the next, and somehow the brutality is banal. You're numb, for better or worse. But there are moments in the day, maybe just a singular moment, when you actually contend with the magnitude of the tragedy, when you're able to quantify the loss, and in those moments you feel crushed." You can read it on his Substack, which we'll link in the show notes. This podcast, Unpacking Zionism, will wrap up with a few new keywords episodes before we turn to a new mini-series on how U.S. Zionist institutions are directing their strategies, their attention, their repression through the public institutions that are maybe most closely knitted into communities, K through 12 schools, elementary schools, and high schools. And they're focusing there because parents and teachers and kids are resisting Zionism. This episode is on the keyword securitization. It's a word that comes most recognizably out of the war on terror, always stitched closely together with Zionism, and is now changing and developing as the landscape of tech levels up the power of repression undertaken in the name of security. We are super lucky to be joined by Nicole Wynn, who teaches at the University of Illinois Chicago. Nicole Wynn, thanks so much for being here. Please tell us a little bit about yourself and how you come to this subject.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I come at this having studied how the global war on terror has shaped domestic affairs, including policing, criminalization, and essentially the repression of social movements in the United States.
So how have you connected that in your research with the specific infrastructure of Zionism from Palestine and the Swana region to the United States?
So I think I do this in a number of different ways. I look a lot at how the concept of terrorism has been sort of put to work to justify policing practices in the U.S., but also transnationally. And a lot of this comes out of, you know, some of the first terrorism legislation was directly targeting Palestinian humanitarian assistance, pro-Palestine movements. It's also looking specifically at the criminalization of Palestinian protesters themselves, but also pro-Palestinian, and really thinking about how the concept of Zionism gets mobilized as a defense of Jewish life, essentially saying that security equals repression of Palestinians and pro-Palestine liberation movements, and that insecurity is anything that's in defense of Palestinian life, and how that then takes many different forms and gets used to do things like attack DEI initiatives that are actually resisting anti-Semitism, but get demonized as anti-Semitic. So really looking at that double movement of how equating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism becomes the pretext for other kinds of repressive projects.
These are connections that stretch across subjects that might feel somewhat separate. For example, the massacres of people in Gaza as they gather for food aid might feel separate or only obliquely connected to conversations about safety on U.S. college campuses. They are, in fact, intimately connected, though. Let's start with kind of the basic idea of securitization. By that, we're not talking about security, being safe. We're talking about how the idea of security and practices that sort of look like, quote, keeping us safe, are used as a tool for other political projects.
Yeah, I think we see the mobilization of security initiatives to justify certain kinds of crackdowns, right? It's creating security projects, policing projects out of things that aren't really attached to security. We can see, for example, that the famine in Gaza, the images of the famine became politically unhealthy. Like Trump kept saying, I don't want to see images of the famine. So it becomes the pretext for Netanyahu to say, we're going to let in food assistance, we're going to let in humanitarian assistance. So these images of famine go away, but it's not because the famine itself goes away. It's because now you've created additional killing zones. That's one way that security gets mobilized to achieve political ends. So it's about the safety and security of Israelis, but being done in the name of Palestinians. We can also see this in the United States, where we had this major crackdown on pro-Palestine encampments across the country. And again, the encampments were seen as a threat to Jewish life on college campuses. And so you had folks who were arrested. And now that becomes the pretext for a kind of ideological deportation process. It becomes the pretext to attack DEI initiatives on college campuses. And so here we're using the security narrative to justify a political project that Trump already had imagined that really is only possible because it is attached to Zionism as an expression of the defense of Jewish life. And so it is the invocation of the security of some that leads to the securitization or this policing, surveillance, and repression of others.
Before we dig into the details, I know that we don't want to make out that securitization is something new that just cropped up. Can you give us a little on where we should be looking for the origins of securitization?
It's like it is two levels, right? It is the sort of post-Cold War rise of independence movement. So countries that are newly independent are figuring out what is our political orientation. And so you saw a lot of crackdown, but also a lot of U.S. politicking to try to shape what those countries were going to be, what they could do. And then there's also the specificity of what's going on in relation to Palestine. So the first law that has terrorism in it is the Foreign Assistance Act in 1969. That's essentially saying we cannot send any foreign assistance to any Palestinian who is even superficially connected to Palestinian liberation movements. This is like the very first instance where we're starting to criminalize humanitarian assistance to Palestinians, with people in the United States sending donations to humanitarian organizations operating in Palestine. We also have the surveillance that's happening through Operation Boulder in 1972, where Arab immigrants have to register, are monitored, are sort of tracked, right? So you have across history this policing of Arabs in general and Palestinians very specifically, with the idea that Palestinian advocacy is a form of terrorism. And that is, again, the narrative we're hearing about Hamas now, and that therefore makes pretty much any kind of policing or security project possible, because it's in defense of U.S. national security, Israeli national security, U.S. life.
That is very resonant in the present moment, as well as an origin story. We're seeing anti-Palestinian racism used to attack Palestinians directly, to marginalize them, to declare them sort of enemies of the state, and also to extend anti-Palestinian racist attacks to the entire mass movement against fascism and Zionism right now. And in fact, we're in the midst of a very bitter contest over who is included in the United States as a citizen, a person with rights, and who isn't, which is a battle that's been continuous since the onset of settler colonialism. And it's also a contest about what groups of people are excludable, whether on the basis of their identity or their ideology or birth. How does securitization play into that?
I think security narratives are really important in defining even who is human, or who — this is Judith Butler's, you know, whose lives are grievable, whose lives count as lives. And we see this continuous call to release the Israeli hostages. And it's always seen as a justification of the killing of Palestinians, that the only way hostages will be released is if there's this constant death dealing within Gaza. And in fact, we can kill millions of Palestinians in defense of Israeli life. I think this is one of the most important parts of how securitization operates, is that it hinges on the dehumanization of some as a way to then defend the life of others.
Let's turn to some of the actors who are actually doing this, this dividing up of people that you're talking about, between one set of people who are identified as needing safety and another set who are identified as dangerous and who are so excluded from safety that they're subjected to a kind of security genocide. We might call it a clash of civilizations theory, the view from the West of a world beyond that's so fundamentally different and threatening that it needs to be dominated for the preservation of the West. That is now entrenched among policymakers and military directors. And we hear it in what you might call the Zionist street too, right? Like we hear it when people are shouting at protesters that Palestinian existence is a demand for genocide against Jews. You sent me an article on Palantir, the massive tech and surveillance corporation, which has been recruiting students on campuses using the language of it's time to take a stand for the West. In June of this year, Palantir's chief technical officer, Shyam Sankar, was inducted as a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army in a new unit to, quote, fuse cutting-edge tech expertise with military innovation, which supposedly he requested himself. And also, he recruited executives from Meta, OpenAI, and Thinking Machines. They were all inducted together. And right after that, the U.S. Army gave Palantir a $10 billion contract. This could not be more dystopian as drones and robot tanks filled with explosives destroy Gaza and murder people en masse. Talk to us about Palantir, not only as a technological producer of weaponry, but as an ideological force driving securitization.
So folks might be more familiar with Palantir in the last few weeks. There's been so many protests against Palantir because it has defined itself as a digital kill chain. The CEO has publicly said this. It's sort of data analytics that comes out of the early days of the global war on terror, where they were creating these algorithms to ingest all kinds of data to figure out like where and who to kill in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we're now feeding Palantir software with NSA data, with all kinds of intelligence data to determine in Gaza who to kill, in the United States, who to deport, who to police, who to survey, and sometimes even also who to kill. It is creating sort of a data analytics infrastructure to enable the kinds of policing and warfare tactics the U.S. wants to create. But it's also creating a sort of narrative atmosphere. The fact that the CEO can publicly say we are a digital kill chain is essentially saying we're refining killing, we're refining our tactics to ensure we're killing the right people, we're deporting the right people, and we're doing it in an effective and efficient manner, right? We are creating a safer world. We're creating a safer United States. And not only that, we want you to invest in Palantir. You know, it's, I think, the highest earning stock over the last year, higher than Nvidia, the Chinese technology. So it's, we want you to invest in this company. We want you to help this company grow, but we also want you to contribute to building the technology, participating in the technology as good citizens who are invested in defending the United States, defending Israel, but also just like defending this idea of who it is we are and what we stand for.
What you're describing is a pretty terrifying citizenship model that Palantir seems to be creating through its security discourse. One part of it is that it's presenting participation in surveillance and tech as good citizenship. And that's a common feature of fascist society and political scares, the Red Scare, the war on terror, the anti-Semitism scare of the present moment. It's like, keep an eye on your neighbor on behalf of the state. There's a second, even more dystopian part, I think, in which Palantir is saying to students, you can be part of governance by joining the militarized tech industry because tech is leapfrogging over democratic processes to exert control far beyond them, right? And to students, they're saying, you can skip all of this intellectual exploration that university life is supposed to be about. You can skip all of this interrogation of values and political ethics, all of this thinking about what states are and what humanity is. Their advertising is literally don't bother with the university. Just bring your 20-year-old masculinist ideology to this company where we will put weapons behind it. So militarized tech corporations like Palantir are creating a pathway to power that circumvents political discourse. and that's interwoven with the way that tech and surveillance are ruling us, imposing discipline in ways that government itself can't, because we have some agreements about government. You know, it violates them all the time, but we do have some agreements. What's your assessment of the larger political work that's done by elevating these firms and this tech, whether it's through a $10 billion contract or the sort of adulation of tech and culture?
I mean, it's doing a number of different things, right? I think this is part of the broader assault on higher education, on critical thought, just like critical political discourse in general, right? It is essentially saying you don't need higher education because there are these high paying jobs that align with your sort of political orientation or the goals you see for the future of the United States. So I think one important thing is that it is slowly chipping away at this idea, this enduring idea that the pathway to upward mobility comes through a college education, and is really saying college education is a crock, right? It's leftist, it's overly liberal, and disavows conservative viewpoints. I also think it's inviting people who would otherwise be targeted by the security state to participate in the security state, right? So I do think that that's one important caveat, and it's something that the United States has done since the onset of the global war on terror, has said, if you don't want to be targeted by the war on terror, participate in it. If you don't want to be targeted by the police, become the police. And so this is partially also about sort of remaking the image of who's doing what, but it is also appealing to that right-wing ethos that says we want to participate in this digital kill chain, and it's incumbent on us to take on this work to really expand American power. This is a moment to decide how strong the United States will stand internationally. That's sort of the messaging the Trump administration is putting out there for young people to really take up. Even the concept of citizenship is sort of up for grabs right now. Even if you look at the United States and the Trump administration, who counts as a citizen or who counts as a good citizen isn't fully determined. So Trump seems to think that, you know, agricultural workers are worth protecting. But when he rubs up against right-wing politics, he says, okay, deport them all. We want to bring the best and the brightest. We want to have this like golden ticket to citizenship where you can buy citizenship. And this, again, rubs up against more conservative folks who say no immigrants ever at any time. And so I do think the concept of citizenship isn't a settled idea. And so this is calling into question who gets to be an elite global citizen. Is it participants in these state security projects? Is it if you participate, you're insulated from policing and surveillance? Does it open access to certain opportunities? But we also see that even if you participate in these projects, it doesn't necessarily mean you actually are protected from policing or deportation. It doesn't necessarily grant you access to elite global citizenship, but it is trying to create some kind of coherence around American power, Western power, to sort of use securitization as a pathway to amass a coherent group of folks who are willing to defend these different kinds of state projects. So I do think the invitation for international students, for students of color to participate in these projects is an important part of what it's doing. And you don't have a data analytics program without international thought. The technological advances depend on its global orientation and its sort of dipping into global knowledge banks. And so it's impossible without sort of that global intellect.
Thinking specifically about college campuses for a moment, they've been a testing ground for the securitization that you're talking about, the surveillance and brute force, and the rhetoric that's used to rationalize it. We've had 2 years of protest against genocide and against university complicity in genocide. 2 years of universities responding almost exclusively by attacking students, faculty, and staff, and shutting down research and education and speech. Where does that stand right now?
There are two ways things have changed. So the first is more sort of the institutional politics, the creation of things like time, manner, and place, rules and policies that are regulating how, when, and where people can protest, and really restricting what that protest looks like and how it can be done. And on the back of those sort of institutional changes, you're also seeing the growth of more aggressive, longstanding security projects. So we saw the repression of encampments as a flashpoint, but you also see universities are now procuring technologies or being invited to integrate new technologies or new surveillance systems into campus policing to continue the criminalization of certain kinds of students who are protesting. And so it is the security narratives that were mobilized during those encampments have created the conditions that allow for this deeper securitization of college campuses and their connections to broader projects. So we can think about, for example, the crackdown on the encampments, creating dossiers that are now being used to deport people. And those narratives are being used to broaden the deportation apparatus beyond Palestinian protesters to all kinds of sort of political dissidents, Chinese communist political dissidents, right, and others. And so I think it's really important that Palestine became such a wedge issue because there was so much mobilization, right? Zionism became the tool to create all kinds of openings for otherwise politically unsavory projects, right? So the idea that you would really and vocally start deporting political dissidents probably wouldn't have been possible until it had been attached to Palestine and Palestinian liberation movements. And we now have a technological infrastructure on college campuses through new partnerships with security companies, with tech companies, with surveillance companies to enact those security projects.
The campus surveillance industry has created some weird bedfellows, I think it's fair to say. Let's talk about them for a minute. There are tech companies doing the surveillance, but then also there are anti-Semitism watchdogs that essentially function as civil society organizations that are offering to help universities surveil what they call anti-Semitism on social media on their campuses. So the Foundation to Combat Anti-Semitism, for example, earlier this year began offering university presidents what it called custom data on social media, including early detection of anti-Semitic threats originating on their campuses. All that is their language. And of course, that kind of surveillance is designed to feed universities the capacity to suppress student events, to suppress teaching or political speech. And we've seen that happen both by what you might call hard force, right, by policing events, and by softer force, like trying to sideline organizers by subjecting them to disciplinary processes like expulsions or requiring them to undergo anti-discrimination trainings. And then there's an even more oblique attack mounted by just denying permission to use campus space, claiming that something is already scheduled, claiming that security is busy that day or whatever. The Foundation to Combat Anti-Semitism is not just a deep well of funding for stuff like this, although it does seem to be quite bottomless. It's funded by a billionaire, Robert Kraft. It's also part of an ecosystem that merges Zionist NGOs with surveillance and tech firms who are linked to the Israeli military and intelligence apparatus. Just for example, Cyberwell is one such military firm that styles itself as an anti-Semitism watchdog surveilling social media, but actually is tied also quite directly to the Israeli military and intelligence apparatus and to the Israeli state. Can you tell us about that infrastructure that seems to be escalating at this moment, where tech firms and NGOs intersect?
Yeah, I think this is where the history of marking Palestinian liberation movements as terrorism is really important, because these sort of institutional arrangements aren't really possible without that long history of tying these kinds of tech projects to, you know, repressing anti-Zionist movements. From the early days of the War on Terror, for example, there were these efforts to monitor social media and criminalize people's social media posts. Security tech companies have always sort of taken on Zionism, whether implicitly or explicitly. And now you're seeing nonprofit organizations saying we're against anti-Semitism and we're inviting companies to contribute to these initiatives. So I think the web is quite tangled in terms of how Zionism shows up, whether it's ideological projects, whether it's their direct connections to Israel, or whether it's more like we want to be against anti-Semitism, which means we're for Zionism. All of this is cohering on college campuses. That's then allowing for all of this surveillance, data collection, intelligence gathering on college students. That's then fueling their criminalization and their policing. Palantir is a really good example of this because Palantir has been used to repress all kinds of protests in the United States. You can think of Occupy Wall Street, for example, but also on college campuses. And now it is the sort of algorithm that's defining the kill list in Israel. Like, it is directly determining who Israel should kill. So the idea that American college students or would-be American college students are contributing to this technology, that it's also being used to direct ICE agents in terms of who to deport, right? So there's this whole security infrastructure that already existed with Palantir in the United States. And its CEO has sort of said, we want to make ourselves of use to the Department of Defense. And so the Department of Defense has mobilized it in Gaza to build out its kill list for Netanyahu. So for me, that's one explicit link between surveillance technology companies in the United States getting mobilized in Gaza.
So far, we've been talking about organizations that are powering securitization, but it also seems to hinge on individuals who facilitate those collaborations, like CEOs of tech firms, individual board members, donors. Bill Ackman, remember Bill Ackman, the hedge fund manager and real estate guy who was a real ringleader in attacks on UPenn and Harvard. Shyam Sankar, who we mentioned, is the tech guy who catalyzed Palantir's collaboration with the U.S. Army, right? Among that sphere, there's a shared disdain for democracy, a hostility toward popular movements, toward people, actually, and a kind of sense of superiority, perhaps you could call it supremacy, right? It feels like a relative of white grievance, of incel complaint, of other kinds of threads of masculinist resentment. It's not coming from a place of care for rights or quote unquote freedom. Can you talk about what kind of cultural liaisons among the super rich tech bros and military types are underwriting securitization right now?
I think it's interesting because people who are overtly anti-Semitic, like self-identified neo-Nazis who are marching in the street, are also somehow Zionist. And it is because it is a part of this broader Trump project. It's sort of like Theo Von might say something on a podcast about Israel that then gets taken up. And so it's, for whatever reason, it's like not a contradiction to be both anti-Semitic and Zionist. It is sort of that bro guy masculinist culture that is, we're going to march in the streets and we're going to scare Jewish people. And also we're going to defend Netanyahu, Israel, and the U.S. project in Gaza. And I do think that part of that is MAGA culture shaping these contradictory politics so that they're not contradictory to people. I don't think those folks have any real affinity towards Zionism. I think they have affinity towards U.S. white supremacist power, and they see this as an exercise of that. And that also seems to me to be Trump's contradiction. He is deeply anti-Semitic, and he's also deeply Zionist because it's politically useful for him right now.
And who are other players that we should be paying attention to? What's their role, whether in technology or producing the rationale for securitization?
I think about this in a number of different ways. So I think there are Israeli Zionist organizations that are actively playing a role. There are nonprofit organizations like ADL that are fueling the securitization narratives. And then there are the private security companies that are enabling the securitization, in some ways also sort of producing those narratives. And I think that includes, if you think about Caterpillar, Lockheed Martin, like I also think the sort of weapons manufacturers also play a key role that I think are talked about a little bit less these days, just because the focus has been so much on surveillance tech.
So a minute ago, I asked you about culture and what's the role of culture in driving this repression. And now I want to ask the second question that we always come to, which is, what is this work doing to move capital, to transform political systems and power systems? What's being built here?
That's such a hard question right now, because I think under prior administrations, I think it would be clear that this is about sort of the transfer of wealth. It's about investing in military tech companies and contracts that is also just tied to sort of a larger U.S. imperial project, regime change, or some kind of control over global governance, while also sort of reconfiguring U.S. democracy to be more authoritarian than before. It's a little bit hard to imbue Trump with that kind of long-term sort of power thinking, aside from this is a way for him to amass enormous executive power. So I think there is a little bit of a question of, is the long-term goal of Trump similar to past presidents, Democratic or Republican, which is about amassing and transferring wealth, about building up these military companies and building up U.S. military presence across the globe? That seems to sort of track with this kind of spending. But does Trump also want to create a Riviera in Gaza? Like, is there sort of personal wealth to be gained? And how might that bear out in alignment or contradiction with some of these more conventional expressions of U.S. empire?
Yeah, one of the things that's so wild about the Trump era, as you say, is that the meanings of things are so unstable. The Trump regime, Trump himself, they're so available for all kinds of different projects to be worked through them. Trump doesn't seem to have any core commitments except to power. So there are lots of actors who are in here trying to leverage their own projects, whether it's groups like the Heritage Foundation or Netanyahu or Arab states that are investing in normalization with Israel in the middle of this genocide. From your study of this sector and the sort of megalomaniacs who occupy it, what other projects are being moved through Trump and the Trump regime?
I think one of them is just clearly Zionism and sort of leveraging this moment as the opportunity for Israeli takeover of Palestine. I do think that that still stands, even as complicated as the Trump administration is. I also think there's this desire to use Zionism in the current political moment to achieve other projects. There are some folks who don't care about Israel, but want to use it to fuel deportations. You know, there are some Arab leaders who want to exploit the situation for gain in the region, right? Are trying to sort of gameplay what a fall of Palestine or fall of Netanyahu might how that might bear out in relation to sort of global politics. There are other folks who want to use the repression of pro-Palestine protests on campus to destroy higher education, to destroy science funding, to destroy cancer research. I think that's why the Zionist project in this moment is so dangerous, because it can attach itself to so many different political projects, giving those political projects legs that it otherwise wouldn't have. So I think there's people within the Trump administration who are thinking that of like, Zionism is really useful for this thing that I want to do, even if it's not really related to Israel. And then I think you have other leaders globally who are thinking about, how do we take this moment with Putin, with Netanyahu, to get what we want? Is this China's opportunity to, you know, begin to dominate more broadly, right? The ascendant movements in Syria, like, is this an opportunity to build something different without the kinds of political pressure, economic sanctions that other presidential administrations might put on different kinds of countries? I think people are just waiting. Like, this is an opportunity for things that wouldn't be otherwise possible or permissible under other presidential administrations.
It's really striking that what these actors are instrumentalizing are discourses of securing rights, democracy, peace, inclusion, sometimes even DEI. And it seems that every time popular movements build ideas about protecting each other that are powerful, they become a target for co-optation. I'm just thinking, for example, about civil rights. Now, indigenous rights has become a target for co-optation by Zionism. Queer rights has been the target for co-optation for homonationalism. The reason security becomes securitization is because it's such a powerfully mobilizing idea, the idea of safety. So how do we resist that?
Yeah, I think one of the lessons from the encampments in the aftermath is that a lot of securitization is about raising the costs of resistance to convince you not to resist. And I see this in social movement repression, but also in sort of conventional political debate. So even with the One Big Beautiful Bill, that the cost of doing business is so high that even if you want to articulate any kind of criticism of the bill, you're too afraid to do that, right? And that's Trump's real strategy, is to raise the costs of resistance so that nobody does it. You're going to deport Palestinian activists because that communicates to everyone, nothing is off the table. We can deport you, we can arrest you, we can kill you. So I think one, it's understanding what privilege you have access to and what kinds of risks you're able to take given this continuous ratcheting up the costs of resisting, and understanding that like this has to be a collective movement, and really figuring out what political project can be worked on in a coherent kind of way. And not every organization, for example, is going to be able to take on the whole of Zionism. Like, we can take on nonprofit collusion with these securitization projects. It could be we're going to take on divestment from weapons manufacturers. I think part of the flood the zone tactic is to make social change seem so impossible with like really high costs that we're just not going to do it, or we just get so discombobulated that we're reacting to every new thing that comes out. The justification for security projects has to be challenged. The materiality of those security projects also needs to be challenged. And then the day-to-day effects on people also needs to be challenged. I don't think there's one that is more important than the other, because you don't have the material security projects without the narrative. You don't have the narrative without the material. And so really thinking about what is possible within someone's orbit to challenge on a consistent basis.
Strategies for a long fight that needs to bring in everyone. Nicole Wynn, thank you again for your insights and for your research. I want to encourage listeners to check out Nicole's prolific writing on the security state, the never-ending war on terror, and its intrusions into education in particular. We'll post a link to that work. We'll also post some writing on Palantir, the Foundation to Combat Antisemitism, and Cyberwell. Please rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts and no longer on Spotify. Follow our Instagram at Institute CSZ and join our mailing list at criticalzionismstudies.org, where you can also buy a t-shirt or a tote bag. Till next time, solidarity from the Institute for the Critical Study of Zionism.